So you can practice that with your friends. Everyone or your friends will have a certain rhythm, a rate of speech, a volume. Sometimes it'll inflect upwards, downwards. The roller coaster will get more energy and less energy. See if you can match that energy as well. The energy levels, the tonality levels, the volume levels, etc. Another level on which you can match people is on the level of pure language. Now, you know for a fact that whenever you enter a social group, each social group has its own vocabulary. If you start talking to traders in the City of London, they have a certain vocabulary, a shorthand, about all their products and the way they talk to each other, and it's unique to them. To you, it may mean nothing because you don't understand what those terms refer back to, but to them, it means everything. And it's a way for them to kind of know insiders and outsiders. And it's true in any human endeavor, any system, any body of knowledge. Whether you join your local women's circle's knitting circle or you become a professor of physics in a university, each social group like that has its own vocabulary and will speak in certain ways about things. So if you start using that vocabulary, that certain jargon, it shows that you're a member of that group. But here's a warning: you can't just pick up the jargon and throw it in there. You have to use it in the same context and with the same tonalities. So for example, if I was going to start using some ghetto slang like yo-yo my brother, the language is there, but my tonality is so wrong. And without even being part of that subgroup, you can hear that it just sounds wrong and it doesn't fit. In the same way as aping and mimicking physically can get people to think that you're trying too hard or maybe be upset with you for aping them. So aping their language or mimicking their language, in other words, using just the words but without the right tonalities and the right rhythms, that can have the same impact as well. So if you're going to use the same vocabulary, make sure you can do it at the whole level, the tonality, and you understand the nuances of when you use the words and when you don't. Make sense?
Yes, it does.
Now there is another level on which your language can match the other person's language on a much simpler level. And that is basically going back to the idea of the filters. Remember the visual, the auditory, and the kinesthetic filters. If someone's a very visual person and says, can you see my point? Let me draw you a picture. Come have a look at this. And you start talking to that person about, I can't get to grips with this. I'm trying to pull myself together, but, I really don't feel it. Can you dig what I'm saying? Well, don't be too surprised if the other person doesn't dig, because the information you're sending at them is going through the wrong filter. It's going to be processed through an inefficient filter. If they like visual information and tend to favor that, if you send information at the kinesthetic level, it's going to take more effort for them to process it, hence it's going to be harder for them to understand. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So again, the VAK language becomes very useful when building rapport because you get to reflect back more visual terms, more auditory terms, etc., according to what the other person requires. You're just going to watch them, you're going to listen to them, and you're going to reflect back their mannerisms, their tonalities, their vocabulary, and the predicates. In other words, hearing language, seeing language, and feeling language. Okay?
Yeah, sure.
Let's turn our attention now to the next foundational skill, calibration. What is calibration? Well, calibration is a kind of signal recognition system. You calibrate someone else when you watch them, you listen to them, and you begin to figure out what relationship have their behaviors, their micro behaviors, in other words, the physiology, the tonality, and etc., what does that relationship have to do with what they're thinking? So you're basically tracking what is called their bemias, their behavioral manifestation of an internal representation. If you ask someone to think of a person they like, they will adopt a certain posture, they'll breathe in a certain way, they'll have a certain skin coloration, etc. If you then ask them to clear their mind and think of someone they dislike, they will change their expression. On a very superficial level, you might see something as simple as a smile and a frown, smiling when they think of a person they like, frowning when they dislike the person. But that's not necessarily always the case. Sometimes people will smile whilst they think of someone who they like, just because they're a smiley person. And it doesn't necessarily mean that smiling means that they like the person they're thinking of. So don't be confused by the surface level. Always track the information. So talk about things they like, and you'll notice what kind of attitude they have, what kind of breathing posture, what kind of behavioral responses. Talk about things that they dislike, and then notice again what kind of breathing posture, etc. they have. Note the distinctions, and then when you introduce a new piece of information, You'll know from their reaction, without them saying anything, whether they unconsciously like or dislike it. And the reason this is interesting is because you'll probably know what their reaction is going to be before they are consciously aware of it. And this has to do with the time lag in consciousness. Very simply put, your conscious awareness is about a half second out of phase with the reality. So the process it takes for information to come in, to be filtered in your unconscious mind to create that map, and you to be aware of that map, that whole process takes about a half a second. So your unconscious mind that's doing all the filtering and, creating of the maps for you is aware of things in real time. You at the conscious level, the intellectual level, will only be aware of things about a half a second after they've occurred. And there's a kind of a strange time loop that gets created in the back of your mind that adjusts backwards for it so that you have the perception that everything's happening in real time, but it isn't really. Now, the reason this is important is because if you present some information to someone and you get a dislike reaction, for example, before they get a chance to disagree with it or tell you they disagree with it and get entrenched in a position, you can rephrase your statement in a way that's going to be more acceptable to them or withdraw it altogether before they get a chance to entrench in a negative position. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Now, in order to be able to do this, it's very important that you understand the difference between calibration and mind reading. Mind reading is kind of you projecting a sense of knowing what's going on inside someone else. In other words, his brow is furrowed, therefore he's angry, right? So your eyebrows are drawn down and furrowed in the center. You must be angry with me. Well, they might not actually be angry. They might just be in pain right now, and they've furrowed their eyes in that particular way because they're trying to not get distracted by it. Or perhaps they're concentrating about something. The eyebrows always furrow in that way when they're concentrating. So what I'm trying to get towards is people tend to project and assume that they know what things mean before they have taken a chance to calibrate and check what actually things really do mean. And it's a mistake to start thinking you know what a response means with a new person just because other people respond that way. Now, to a certain extent, you can take that, people smiling and being friendly, etc., means that they're in a reasonably good mood and vice versa. But never take it all on face value. Sometimes people can be friendly, but there's like an underlying tension. And you won't know what that underlying tension is unless you start paying attention and you maybe see that the corner of their eye is not as relaxed as it could be or you've seen other times. And ultimately, you need to have contrasts, which goes right back to the idea of throwing polar opposite information, things they like and dislike, things they'll agree to and disagree to, throwing that kind of information at them so you can contrast the reactions and you know what the reactions start to mean. The simple rule of thumb is to keep yourself sensory based. Don't say, oh, when I talk about my mother, that person feels angry. It's to say that when I talk about my mother, I see that person furrow their eyebrows and turn red in the face and shake their head from side to side and hold their breath. Okay? Now, you might take an educated guess at that point that that means anger, but at least you know you're taking an educated guess so that if there is something that doesn't quite add up later on, you can go back and change your assumption or at least test it. So always make sure that you realize that when you think you know what something means, it's only an educated guess. It's not the real world. It's not reality. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
So, do you understand the foundations of rapport and calibration as they relate to NLP?
Yeah.
Now, these are going to be core skills for you to get very good at, and this is very good for hypnotists in general because building rapport with people opens them up to be able to use hypnosis to open up their unconscious mind. In other words, it allows the defense mechanisms to calm down, and trust and comfort tend to quiet the activity of the critical factor. Also, you understand calibration, you want to see the signals and recognize them for what they mean so that you know what impact you're having. The meaning of your communication is the response you get. If you don't even notice a response, if you're not aware of a response, how are you going to know what meaning the other person is going to take? So, sharpen your awareness, sharpen your senses, and get used to building rapport, use the instant rapport technique, and get very good at those core skills because everything you do from this point onwards is going to rely on that.
Yeah, sure.
Right, now we're coming on to the final portion of this session. The final portion is all about outcomes. Human beings are goal-oriented devices. We seek goals. When we don't have a goal, then, well, basically the idea of, going nowhere. If you don't know where you're going, you'll be going nowhere fast. So people need goals. If they don't have goals, they should have an unconscious goal, and it may be an unhealthy one. So part of NLP, particularly when you do use NLP in the therapeutic context, but it's also good in terms of sales and management and teaching, etc., is to create an outcome, a goal that people can reach with the interaction you're about to have. Now, what do we need for goals? Well, before we talk about goal setting in general, in order to achieve success in life, to achieve any excellence in any field, there's a simple formula I like to call PACE that lies at the heart of NLP that is going to drive all your behaviors and drive all your learning. PACE stands for purpose, adapt, calibrate, and engage. Your purpose is basically to know your outcome. You need to know what you're trying to achieve. Otherwise, how are you going to know what behaviors to engage in? How are you going to know what's paying off and what isn't paying off? So you need to have a purpose. You need to try and achieve something. That's what goals are all about. Next, you need to be flexible. That's what adaption is all about. If you don't adapt, if you're inflexible, if you're basically starting off on your journey and you're 1 degree on the wrong course, let's say you notice you're going in the wrong course. If you're inflexible and keep going in the same direction regardless, don't be too surprised if you don't reach your goal. Why? Because you're not being flexible about it. So there comes an old adage here, is to say, if you keep doing what you've been doing, or keep getting what you've been getting. So if you want a different result, you need to do anything different. In other words, you have to do anything other than what you have done. Expect a different result from the exact same behavior is, in one sense of the word, a definition of madness. Because how is it going to change if nothing else has changed? And unfortunately, people sometimes get into loops. If only I keep doing this thing, then I'll get the result I want. And I just keep doing it with almost compulsive and obsessive tendencies, instead of becoming flexible and trying different behaviors, different solutions, different approaches, until they find the one that works best, or start acquiring that this little change helped in this way, so making more of that change might help, or making less of that change but more of the other change might help. Make sense?
Yeah, sure.
So, you know your outcome and you're being flexible, you're trying all kinds of different behaviors out, etc. If you can't calibrate, if you're not using your senses to get feedback, well, you might be trying out different paths, but you still might not be able to reach the city you're trying to aim for, because if your eyes are shut, how are you going to know what direction you're going in? How are you going to know how close to that city you're at? So you have to open your eyes and pay attention to what's going on. So you have to gather feedback. The feedback will tell you, are you getting closer to your goal, in which case do more of it, or are you getting further away from the goal, in which case do less of it. So your calibration feeds back into your adaption, in other words, your ability to be flexible, because when you move too far from your goal, your flexibility demands a new set of behaviors to redress the balance. And if you're right on track, your calibration demands that you become inflexible. In other words, you keep doing what you're doing because you're right on track. So you have purpose, you have adaption, and you have calibration. All these things are absolutely no good at all if all you're doing is thinking about them. Until you engage, until you start taking action right now in the moment, nothing will happen. You'll have no excellence, you'll have no results, you'll have nothing. Why? Because it requires action to get results. So the formula for success, the formula for excellence is PACE. Have a purpose, adapt, calibrate, and engage. Now, with this idea in mind, let's look at that first step. What is the purpose? Because if you have no purpose, you have no real goal in mind, how are you going to know what you're going to calibrate against? So at this point, we're going to look at basically what's called the well-formed outcome conditions. Now, before we look at the well-formed outcomes in totality, let's look at them in terms of a reduced version. Everyone has probably heard of the SMART formula for setting goals. SMART stands for be specific, M stands for be measurable, A for have affect, in other words, an emotional content, R for reasonable, and T for timed. Specific means you have to know what the goal is, not generally like I want more money, but I want to have $100,000 sitting in my bank account. Measurable is you have to have some kind of evidence procedure. You have to know when you've achieved it, otherwise, how do you know when to stop? Affect means there needs to be an emotion in the goal. If there's no emotion in it, there's no motivation. Emotion is the fuel that drives the unconscious mind. Reasonable means basically it's got to be possible. If you can't do it, if you have lost an arm and your goal is to regrow the arm, well, under the current scientific technology, we can't do it. You may want to start investigating ways of regrowing cellular growth, etc. It's an entirely different thing. But just to will your arm to grow and make it grow, well, currently, I know of nobody that has learned the trick of willing it in such a way that will make a lost arm regrow. So we need to look at reasonableness. Is it rational? Is it something you can do? Finally, timed. Time has a essential nature in goals, because if you don't put a time limit on something, you may never achieve it. And your unconscious mind will be quite happy because it's not violating your purpose, because you can achieve it any time before you die. So how do those get conformed into a what's called a well-formed outcomes? Well-formed outcomes are basically the same idea as SMART goals, but just looked at them in more specific detail. There are 7 conditions for a well-formed outcome. The first is that it's stated in the positive. What is it that you want? People often tell you what they don't want. I don't want a headache. I don't want to feel afraid. I don't want to fail. The reason they're failing, partly, is because unconsciously the internal representation of the map is one of failure. The terrain they're looking at is the terrain where they're failing. So they have no concept of what it means to succeed because they're not even thinking about it. It's like not thinking about a red cat. You know the old one? Don't think of a red cat. Don't think of a red cat sitting in a red tree. Don't think of that little red cat licking its little red paw right now. So tell me, Sean, what comes to mind as you're thinking about it?
Little red cat licking its paw.
Exactly. You have to have the experience before you can negate it. The same is true if you're driving. If you're driving and you're not watching the road, if you're looking at, say, the pavement or the sidewalk, and you never even bother looking at the road, where do you think the car is going to start steering? The pavement, the sidewalk. Because the car goes where your attention goes. So where attention goes, energy flows. Don't put the energy on feeling afraid and feeling bad about yourself. Put the energy in feeling confident, in feeling good about yourself. Don't look at the territory where you are failing. Look at the territory where you are succeeding, what you want. State in the positive. Secondly, make it sensory based. The senses are the language of the mind. Don't make abstraction of ideas. I want more love. What does love mean? Love might mean to you having people stroke your head and whisper sweet nothings in your ear. It might just be people talking to you with a kind expression. It might just be a tone of voice. It might be lots of people being around you having a good time. The word love will mean something different to each person. And until you can track it down to a sensory thing, how can you measure it? How can you know you've achieved it? And how can you even go for it? So make sure it's something that you're seeing, hearing, and feeling tells you you've achieved this goal. The third rule is it should be initiated and maintained by the individual. What we mean by this is, sometimes people create magical goals. I want to win the lottery. Now, can you spot a flaw with the goal, I want to win the lottery?
Well, it's not specific, it's not measurable, it's not probably not achievable.
Well, let's make it specific. Really. I want to win Tuesday, I want to win the $1.3 million jackpot in the lottery. So I've got time, I'm specific about it. You know, I'll know exactly when I've had it. I can visualize myself, you know, getting the numbers, and the TV's got the numbers on the TV, and I've got the numbers in my hand. So it's all, it's measurable, it's specific. What's the problem with that?
There's no plan on how to get there.
There's no control, right?
Yeah.
It's not statistically, I have no control over it. The ball comes out of the machine. Now, if I had psychic powers, I could make the ball come out of the machine the way I wanted to. That's one thing. If I had magical powers and I could send spirits to do that for me, that's another thing. But in the absence of those, can you begin the process of winning it other than buying a ticket? The rest is out of your hands. Can you maintain it? It's out of your hands. So if it's out of your hands, then there's a flaw in the goal because there's nothing you can do about it. Sometimes people really mess themselves up by setting goals that are outside of their ability to influence. I'll be happy when she's happy. But if that person has, you know, emotional issues, you're predicating your happiness on something that's not inside of your ability to dictate. In other words, how the other person thinks, feels, and behaves. Sure, you can influence it, but until you start working on what you can do, which is to say, how do I influence the other person, now it becomes something you can initiate and maintain. But it's not about making the other person happy. It's about doing things that will influence the other person with the purpose of maybe over time helping them feel more happy and things. Do you understand that distinction?
Sure.
There's another problem with this. Let's say my goal is to be a multimillionaire, and I can do this. I'm going to work 80 hours, 100 hours each week. I'm going to work weekends. I'm going to get up at 5 a.m. and I'm going to sleep at 1 in the morning. And I'm going to sleep for 4 hours and I'm going to do the whole thing again. Now, for some period of time, I can probably do that, right? But can I maintain that? If it takes that much effort to earn $1 million and keep, you know, my income at that level, can I actually maintain it? No. And if I can't maintain it, because I'll reach burnout at some point, well, in that case, my goal is doomed to failure. This is one of the classic problems people have when they, for example, have a diet goal. Their goal can be initiated. In other words, they can eat less of whatever food and count calories and buy this weird supplement or that weird supplement and do whatever it is. But they're never built into the equation of the goal a maintenance program. Build in how they can starve themselves to get to the ideal weight. But once they're there, there's no maintenance program. In other words, the effort to maintain it is so great that they drop it. And when they drop it, of course, all the results get lost as well. And the weight piles back on. Usually they end up having more weight than they started off with. So if they're going to have a well-formed outcome, they're not going to just talk about how they initiate it. In other words, how they get to the ideal weight or shape. They need to include as part of the whole thing how they'll live their life generally so they keep maintaining it after they've reached it. Do you understand the difference?
Right, okay, yeah.
The next thing is ecology. Ecology is basically the study of consequences. So what are the consequences of making this change? So let's imagine that a woman has issues with her sexuality, is married, and is enormously fat to the point where her husband really doesn't want to cuddle up to her and make love to her. So far, she is protected. Why? Because her fat is literally a shield that keeps her from having to wrestle with her sexuality. If now you help her to diet and become slim and trim and beautiful, now she's going to be more desirable by men. She doesn't know how to deal with that. Now she's got a bigger problem than just being big. So was the change ethical? Was it ecological? No, because there was a piece missing. In order for her to be able to lose weight safely, she first needs to deal with her sexuality and be okay with her sexuality, be okay with maybe being found desirable by men. At that point, she no longer needs a shield, the protection. At that point, losing the weight is going to be much easier because it's ecological. If you're going to change behaviors, if you're going to change the way people feel about things, make sure that it's in the whole context of their life so that it fits, it's actually beneficial to them. So you ask questions like, what else will happen once you've achieved this goal? Who else will be affected? How might others benefit from you achieving this goal? What might others think and feel from you achieving this goal? So always have an eye for the impact of the change in the greater circumference of their life. Rule number 5 of the well-formed outcome conditions is preserve the positive byproduct of the present state. What do we mean by this? Well, we'll come to the idea of secondary gain. Hypnosis, we should be familiar with the idea of secondary gain. When someone has a problem or a limitation, sometimes it serves a purpose. In fact, it always serves some kind of purpose. So let's say, for example, the very harsh example that you gave me, Sean, of a child abuser. The purpose it serves is to make the person feel powerful. Now, if your solution to child abuse is to make the person so disempowered, so they feel so out of control that, you know, you hope to then make them too afraid of abusing further children. Well, guess what? If the only way they can feel powerful is to abuse children and you make them feel even less powerful, you've just increased their drive to go and abuse children. You haven't got rid of it. So for the short brief moment in time, they may stop, but you can virtually guarantee it's going to come back again in some shape or form. So when you preserve the positive byproduct of the present state, you want to preserve what is the positive element, what's the positive intention. So if you're going to change, if you're going to help a child abuser change his ways, you're going to find better behaviors that make him feel powerful. Let's say you teach him something like self-hypnosis, and in self-hypnosis feels like $1 million. Now he has something that makes him feel powerful. Great. Let's give a less extreme example. Let's take a example, for example, a lady who has pain in the forearm, phantom pain, In other words, there's no organic cause for it, and you take it away. Let's say it's an old lady and she's lonely, and in the old lady's home that she lives in, by complaining about this pain, people, tut and say, "Oh, you poor dear," and pay her attention. So she needs attention from people. She wants attention. She wants to not feel adrift in the world. If you take the pain away, she's lost her reason, her ability to complain. She's lost her lifeline to getting attention from the outside world. Do you think that pain's going to go away? Or at least stay away if you make it disappear after a while? No, because she needs it. So until you help her find other ways of getting the positive byproduct, in other words, the attention, well, go away. So do you understand the idea of preserving the positive byproduct of the present state?
Sure.
So you always ask the question, how has that problem or limitation been useful to you? And you find other ways of engaging them that will still achieve that same purpose. Next, you come on to the sixth step, which is it specific and contextualized? To a certain extent, you get this when you have sensory-based information, what will you be seeing, hearing, and feeling. But you really want to create also a time-space continuum. Where will it happen? When will it happen? Who will be around? That basically orients it in time and space. So time is one thing, but location is also important. Is it going to be in your home that you achieve this? For example, if you want to achieve confidence, and the only time you're ever confident is when you're in your bathroom, well, you've achieved confidence. Well done. And you've done it by the required date. You can feel it, you can hear it, and all the rest of it. But the minute you walk out and you face your family, or you go out into the real world and you face your job and your prospects and your clients, that confidence comes crashing down your ears. Has anything useful been achieved? Well, maybe a little bit, in that you can feel comfortable and confident in one place, but it hasn't really fulfilled the purpose of the goal yet. So if your goal is to feel confident, make sure there's a context. Where and when are you going to feel confident? The final question, number seven, or the seventh condition, does it include an internal process, an internal state, and an external behavior? So process, state, and behavior is what drives achievements. If you want to become a tennis champion, you're going to have to think about tennis in a certain way, so and understand strategy in tennis. You have to feel a certain way. That's the fuel that keeps you motivated to keep practicing and playing and have the drive to win. And you have to have an external behavior. You have to practice every single day your forehand, your backhand, different strategies. And you have to, of course, be able to apply that practice in the actual court when you're playing tennis. So you need to ask, what will you be doing? How will you be thinking? How will you be feeling in order to have a complete picture of your goal? So things that happen inside, how are you thinking, how are you feeling, and things you're doing on the outside, how you're behaving as a result of those. When you have these seven conditions built into a goal, it's known as a well-formed outcome. It's a well-formed goal. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it does.
Now, to a certain extent, I'm teaching this because this is part of what the NLP process requires, but bear in mind that there are some flaws in the well-formed outcome. For example, you can still create a dirty goal, which is well-formed. In other words, a goal which has an unconscious conflict with it. So the harder you try and achieve it, the greater the conflict arises and the less likely it is you're going to achieve it. But you can still imagine it in sensory-based terms. You can still state it in the positive. You might still think it's ecological. It actually won't be ecological because you've missed out on something. And here's the key flaw with the well-formed outcome conditions, is that you're asking someone's conscious mind, their intellect, to choose the well-formed outcome. Whereas really, you need to include their unconscious mind. So when you're setting the well-formed outcome conditions, you need to have your calibrations on super alert for any kind of incongruity. If you ask them, is this going to be ecological? What are the people going to say and feel? And they go, that can be great. And there's kind of a catch there. Well, you want to check that out because maybe the unconscious mind knows something that they don't know. So with that in Taking all that in the big picture, let's just summarize what we did today. We introduced NLP as a concept, its history, and the idea that NLP is really a covert form of hypnosis. It's the act of suggesting something to the other person in order to influence them at the unconscious level. We looked at the NLP model of the mind, the bird whistle study, where language, tonality, and behavior all have an important role to play in the communication process. And then we looked at the whole communication process in terms of the universal modeling process, how the information comes in through the senses, they hear a word or a sentence, they see someone behaving a certain way. It gets filtered through, deleted, distorted, and generalized, and leaves a map, an internal representation. That map, in turn, makes them feel a certain way, behave a certain way, and changes their physiology. So they will, their state, their behavior, and their physiology gets changed. Next, we focused in on those filters, and we looked specifically at the presuppositions of NLP, which are useful filters to adopt in order to be more successful in life, and in particular, in applying the techniques that NLP has developed. Then we looked at the chunking and sequencing of information, how much detail or how much of a big picture to give people, and in what order to present information so that they can achieve it. Then we looked at perceptual positions, looking at it from your point of view, look at it from their point of view, and look at it from a neutral party's point of view to understand the situation from many different perspectives to get a greater insight into the nature of the situation. Then we looked at a very important concept of the sensory modalities, sensory thinking. People think in either pictures, sounds, or feelings primarily. Some people will use olfactory and gustatory as well, but they're a very, very small number. So they tend to prefer one of these modes of thinking as well. Some people prefer to think in pictures, some in sounds, some in feelings. And by reflecting these back, you get to activate the mind more fully. You can hear the way they're thinking in their language, the words they use, the predicates, hearing words and feeling words and seeing words. You can also see it in their eyes, their eye movement patterns. And when the eye movements tell you either what their primary system is, what they prefer, their lead system, in other words, the cover, or the place they need to go to acquire the information. So to hear a singer, they might have to make a picture first to recover the information. And the synesthesia, where two in systems are so interlocked with each other that activating one will trigger the other one automatically. We looked at that in terms of eye accessing cues and how that relates to strategies, how people make decisions, how to understand when to start and stop things, and how you can track those behaviors or track those strategies through their eye accessing and cues. Then we looked at rapport and calibration, how to create a sense of comfort and trust in other people, and how to read their signals, these bemias, the behavioral manifestations of an internal representation, in order to be able to tell what their map is, what map are they operating from, how are they feeling, what are they thinking at any point in time. Finally, we looked at goals, in particular the SMART goal formula and the more extensive well-formed outcome conditions. We looked at the 7 conditions of a well-formed outcome, and in particular, we noted that, very importantly, there's a fundamental flaw in that when people just use their conscious mind to create well-formed outcomes, sometimes they will miss out on something, an ecological thing at the unconscious level that creates a dirty goal and can create and distort basically the goal. As hypnotists, we want to be aware of this so that we can spot it when it happens, or if things don't go according to plan, we can always come back and test to see if there's a dirty goal somewhere, if there's an unconscious conflict with something that was in the well-formed outcome. So, now that we've completed the foundational session on NLP, do you have any questions or comments on the concepts that we've talked about in this session?
No, I don't think I do. That all made a lot of sense, really. So a lot of information there. Yeah.
It's a lot of information. So go back through the manual and check each one as you go along. Listen back to the recording again, of course. But this is basically the foundation of all the NLP. Everything we do from here on is going to assume that you know this and that you can use the skills like setting goals and creating rapport, etc., as a result of which you can be able to do the other things that we're going to do. If you can't do these, it's going to be very difficult, possibly even impossible, to do the other things because they require this foundation. So with that happy thought, I look forward to seeing you guys again in session 2, where we'll be diving into some of the actual skills that you require in NLP. We're going to look specifically at language models and some of the other things that you can do with language that NLP has to offer. Until then, I look forward to seeing you, and feel free to just go over this material as often as you need to until you really understand the subtleties within each concept, because this is where the real gold dust of NLP lies. Take care, and goodbye for now.